Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, an important recruitment message from the Luddite Society. I hope you'll stay tuned. Here are some thoughts about the Luddites, mostly positive thoughts. I've arranged these thoughts into four short chapters, which I will speak today, with a little music here and there to spice things up. Chapter 1 is about coming out as a Luddite. Chapter 2 tells the true history of the Luddites. Then on to The Luddites' World is Our World. And finally, a reflection on Luddism in our consumer culture. Chapter 1, Coming Out as a Luddite. For years I've known that I was somehow different from other people, and there wasn't any polite language to describe the difference. The media never acknowledged that people like me even existed, or even that there were people like me. On the rare occasion people even recognized we existed, they'd refer to us by nasty names. Technophobe, or worse, Luddite. So I just kept my thoughts and feelings to myself, stayed in the closet, as it were. Well, other closeted minorities had it even worse than us. For example, gays and lesbians, and Kansas Democrats. So I figured, if they can come out, and even get some measure of justice, I can come out. So here goes. My name is Kenneth Doust. I am a Luddite, and I'm proud. You'll just have to deal with it. Don't even think of trying to sell me an internet-connected smart thermostat. And if your name is Alexa, better keep off of my property. There. I feel better already. The next step is to start an organization to give ourselves some mutual help and support. Nothing too grandiose sounding for a title. How about Luddite Society of Connecticut, Greater Hartford Chapter? If you're interested in joining, just send me a note, preferably by U.S. mail, bicycle messenger, or carrier pigeon. As I said, when people use the term Luddite, it's usually an insult. They falsely think of Luddites as neurotics, people who are entirely wedded to old-fashioned ways, people who are insanely opposed to all modern improvements, people who use a backyard privy because they don't trust newfangled inventions like flush toilets. Well, that's what Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and everyone with a new gadget to sell want you to think about us. But that's a crock. Luddites like modern technology just fine, when the technology increases people's freedom and power and dignity and ease of living. We just don't like technology that does the opposite, which, alas, is most of the new technology that they're now trying to foist upon us. Chapter 2, True History of the Luddites. Let's go back two centuries. The original Luddites lived in England in the early 19th century. They were craftsmen, weavers, and other skilled textile workers. Back then, skilled workers had much more power and control over their working conditions on the job than they do today. But the Industrial Revolution was underway. Newly invented, much more automated factory equipment was installed in the textile mills. And instead of skilled craftsmen, factory owners wanted low-paid, less skilled workers whose job would be mainly to tend to the machines. Just like today. The weavers and such correctly saw that the new machines and processes and work rules would seriously degrade their working conditions, their pay, their social standing, their whole lives, and their families' lives. So the threatened workers began destroying the new machines. Karl Marx noted that the threatened workers would have been wiser to try to destroy the capitalist system instead. But capitalism was too abstract and nebulous an enemy, so the workers started attacking the immediate threat, the machines. The rebellion began in Nottingham in March 1811. It rapidly spread throughout England. The rebellion lasted until 1817 or so, some 6 years. Factory owners and the English army and parliament all fought back, of course, and many deaths resulted. Mostly deaths of the rebellious workers, needless to say. The rebellion was eventually ruthlessly put down by the authorities. The Luddites' predictions were quite correct. Over the next decades, wages were cut, work hours increased, working conditions deteriorated, unemployment grew, poverty increased. The lives of English textile workers declined to the level of squalid wretchedness. Those were Lord Byron's words, squalid wretchedness. Yes, that Lord Byron, the poet. Among the upper class, Byron was one of the extremely few defenders of the Luddites and their descendants. Ironically, Byron's only legitimate daughter was one of the inventors of the modern computer. She is usually credited with being the first computer programmer. I say ironically because the computer is now doing to today's skilled workers what the newfangled machinery did to the textile workers in Lord Byron's day. Ask any machinist or welder. In fact, the daughter's contributions to computer design were much influenced by those newfangled industrial weaving machines that the Luddites tried to destroy with Lord Byron's blessing, particularly the Jacquard loom. The lady, of course, was the now celebrated Ada Lovelace. Cherchez la femme, as they say, or as Kurt Vonnegut would put it, so it goes.
As we've seen earlier, hierarchical control makes people feel worse about themselves. It creates more mental illness, creates bad relations outside the workplace. Well, if people spend most of their time in a collaborative workplace, they become more collaborative. They care more about each other. You can have a democratic corporation, a worker-owned business, and a worker-owned business that really is managed by the workers, that uses the corporate form. And that gives us some hope because it's possible, at least theoretically, to reform corporations.
Participatory economics is the name for a different way to do the economy. It's a different approach to accomplishing production, consumption, and allocation, economic functions, different than what? Different than capitalism, and different than what went under the name socialism, but I tried to describe as coordinatorism, as this class of engineers and managers and doctors and lawyers being at the top. So participatory economics, or par econ, is an alternative to all of that. It's a different kind of economy. In a participatory economy, in a good economy, instead of organizing economic life to keep a small sector of people on top and to enrich them beyond any sensibility, and to utilize productive apparatus even when it entails doing things that are a complete waste of time, building missiles that will never be used, on and on and on. Instead of all that, we would produce and distribute for purposes of human fulfillment and development. You don't need all this military production, of course not. You don't need, nor do you want to, generate all kinds of activity and product which doesn't make people better off.
As workers around the globe continue to struggle for workplace democracy and equal rights, mass production continues apace. In China, scientific management has taken on nightmarish proportions. So extensive is the division of labor that millions of people are forced to perform roughly the same motion thousands of times a day. In the United States, workers in some assembly plants are required to be in continual motion for up to 57 seconds a minute. In Indonesia, sweatshops owned by corporations like Nike chart productivity down to a thousandth of a second. In offices and service industries, corporations are increasingly resorting to video surveillance and computerized monitoring.
That was a clip from the film Human Resources by Scott Noble. I thought it made a nice introduction to Chapter 3. Chapter 3. The Luddites' World is Our World. Now, English weavers in 1811 may seem remote, but there are strong connections between them and us. What did many of the English mills weave? Cotton. American cotton. Grown and harvested by enslaved people in the United States. Baled, then shipped to Liverpool for the value added, as we would now say. Then, in Nottinghamshire and elsewhere in England, the cotton was spun and woven into cloth by workers. Workers whose lives were steadily being reduced to a squalid wretchedness that came to rival that of the enslaved workers at the other end of the production chain. Meanwhile, in America, in addition to all the horrors of slavery, the soil in the South was being depleted by season after season of nothing but cotton. Even those plantation owners who wanted to switch for a while to soybeans or something to replenish the soil were not able to do so. Farms require a steady supply of bank loans to even out the cash flow, and the bankers would finance nothing but cotton, for which they knew there was a steady demand. With cotton, there was a very good chance that their loans would be repaid. With soybeans, who knows? So, the banker said, keep growing cotton until the soil is too depleted to grow any more. Then you can figure out your next move. So who profited from this whole bizarre, inhuman system? Not the slave workers in the United States, not the increasingly miserable textile workers in England, certainly not the environment. Even some of the plantation owners were not doing well, given the weird global market for bulk cotton. The only people making any real money on either side of the Atlantic were some of the plantation owners and the English factory owners and the bankers. Does this sound at all familiar? Does this sound just a little bit like 21st century America? Capitalism has not changed much since 1811. It's only gotten more powerful. Even globalization and a global supply chain are not new. As we saw, they were firmly in place by 1811, the year the Luddites struck back. The Luddites damaged the only thing the capitalist class has ever cared about, their capital investment and their profits. So, you have to wonder if the Luddites were as misguided as our leaders want you to think. Maybe the Luddites knew what they were doing. Maybe their rage against the machine made sense. Here's another irony. Today, the people smashing the textile machinery are the capitalists themselves. In Haiti and Honduras and Vietnam and China, you can pay textile workers even less than you could in Nottingham, England, or Lowell, Massachusetts. They're closing down the textile mills by the railroad track. Foreman said these jobs are going, son, and they ain't coming back to your hometown. As the poet said. No, not Lord Byron, another poet. There's no sense smashing any remaining computer numerical controlled industrial weaving machines now. The factory owners will gladly collect the insurance money and move production to China. But what's today's Luddite equivalent? Is there an industry in which a full-blown Luddite rebellion would make sense? Food for thought. Big oil? Trans-Pacific shipping? Fishing? Nuclear power? Artificial intelligence? Robotics? Of course, neither I nor this radio station's staff or management, let alone the licensee, advocates or condones unlawful destruction of private property or any other form of violence. Just a little thought experiment. But is there a smaller-scale Luddism that might make sense in our own world, here and now?
1, 2, 3, 4. First you have to have a problem. That part isn't hard. The second step is everybody realizing they're like you, they're holding the same card. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change. So quick. The congressmen and businessmen and TV sets will try hard to make sure it isn't so. You don't have a problem. If you do, it's not the same problem. And if it is, well, there's just nowhere you can go. But that many times, the history is rich, though we easily forget how a meme can take hold and grab you, how it can spread out like a net, and everything can change. So quick. They'll say we are lost or we're dreaming, or they'll make a dream for us. They'll try to come up with a good story about why we belong at the back of the bus, about why we belong in this position, about how we don't know what we meant, about how there most certainly isn't any such thing as the 99%, but everything can change. So quick. Everything can change. So quick.
Chapter 4, The Possibility of Luddism in Consumer Culture, or It's Okay to Start Small. Maybe two, or instead, we could each do some small-scale Luddite rebelling in our own lives? I myself am increasingly feeling that the latest technology is making my life poorer, more precarious, less full, much more vulnerable to vandalism, more distracted, more personally competitive, less social. And every new gadget that connects in any way to the internet now seems to bring a staggering loss of privacy. Here's just the latest example, which I read not a week ago in an AP news story in my local rag. It seems that hook up a new smart TV and every viewing decision you make is reported in real time to the data aggregators and the marketing types, who will immediately send targeted ads to your personal computer and your smartphone, and keep a record of exactly what you are viewing, when, and for how long. And you get to pay for the broadband. Oh, you gotta love the modern improvements. Indeed, the whole blankety-blank internet has now become as oppressive as it is helpful. This is a far cry from the idealistic visions held by the Internet's naive founders. Hey, guys! 3/4 of the early funding for Internet research and development came from the Defense Department. That should have been a red flag, right? But back to consumer products. Does anyone feel that her smartphone has made her life easier, less demanding, and less stressful? Now that you have a smartphone, does your life now have more leisure time or less? If you work in business, how do you like being on call 24 hours a day, expected to address every minor business problem or question instantly at all hours of the day and night, 7 days a week? Now, in a sense, you can never go home from the office, can you? And for your bondage, you're paying, say, $1,200 a year out of your own pocket. Such a deal. Nor can you ever get away from your kids, even for a few hours, as they all have smartphones too, and expect instant replies to all queries. Even after they've gone off to college, you're still texting back and forth 8 times a day. When I went off to college, I'd call home from a payphone once every 2 or 3 weeks. Somehow we all survived. Maybe I even learned a little self-reliance. Here's a mini-Luddite possibility you might consider. Throw away your smartphone. Tell the phone company you want your home landline reinstalled. And or buy a cheap pay-per-minute mobile flip phone. No internet connection, good for voice only. That will cost you maybe $30 for the phone, plus $100 a year for 400 minutes of calling time, which is plenty. That's less than 10% of the cost in buying and using a smartphone, right? The money you save will more than pay for a landline and an answering machine for that. That's what I do, and I keep the mobile flip phone turned off most of the time. I just pack it to make calls when I'm away from home. Or you can skip the landline, just use the voice-only mobile. With the money you save, you can pay off your credit card debt and feel even better. Maybe full-blown Luddism isn't right for you, smashing machinery on the job and so on. Say, maybe you're self-employed. So what on-the-job machinery are you going to smash? Your printing calculator? Well, if hardcore Luddism doesn't seem to work for you, how about giving softcore a try, so to speak? Find some consumer machines that are making your life more complicated, more stressful, more miserable, and chuck 'em. Maybe replace them with something simpler. Maybe just do without. If you're not yet ready to chuck your smartphone, okay, work up to it gradually. Get rid of 25 apps on the phone. Or you could maybe start with kitchen gadgets. That electrically powered automatic bread-making machine that you haven't touched in 3 years, maybe? How about that electric food processor that takes forever to disassemble, wash, dry, and reassemble? How often do you do something with it that you couldn't do just as well with a box grater and or a sharp knife? Incidentally, if anyone wants my electric panini maker, it's yours. Though in good conscience, I have to recommend that you don't touch it. With each small act of mini-Luddism, you'll feel happier and feel better about yourself. Work your way up to the smartphone. And if you even think about installing an internet-connected smart front door lock, so the Amazon Prime driver can use a one-time-only numeric access code to open your door and leave your weekly order of groceries, chocolate, and disposable baby diapers in your foyer, if this is your fond fantasy, then I'm afraid the Luddite Society of Connecticut Greater Hartford Chapter is not really what you need. you might try psychiatry if you can afford it. Or if not, maybe a nice religious cult. And when hackers from Elbonia remotely freeze up your door lock and demand $500 to let you back into your house, or when local hackers electronically unlock your front door and carry off your smart TV, smart washing machine, smart thermostat, Alexa, your fitness monitor, stereo, silverware, camera, money, bicycles, and electric panini maker. I say, when these entirely predictable events come to pass, ask yourself what was so bad about the old door lock operated by a brass key and buying your baby diapers and chocolates and groceries at Costco or the neighborhood supermarket, where Gladys at the register might recognize you and ask how your daughter is doing off at college. And you can reply, you're worried because you haven't heard from her since noon. No, fancier and more powerful machines are not the answer. Come on, people, smile on your brother. Everybody get together, and surely you can find some machine worth smashing. Look around the house and check your pockets. And with that, we must end this installment of New World Notes. The song Everything Can Change was by David Rovics. Luddism notwithstanding, you'll find a free archive of our show on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening. And since we've taken his name in vain several times this past half hour, let us end with a poem by Lord Byron. When a man hath no freedom to fight for at home, let him combat for that of his neighbors. Let him think of the glories of Greece and of Rome, and get knocked on his head for his labors. To do good to mankind is the chivalrous plan, and is always as nobly requited. Then battle for freedom wherever you can, and if not shot or hanged, you'll get knighted.